Good morning. I'd like to start with the calculation of the amount of the loss under the sentencing guidelines. And the reason I'd like to start here is because the trial court made a legal error that is subject to de novo review. Specifically, in calculating the amount of the loss resulting from the offense conduct, the trial court found that intervening fraudulent acts of a third party could not terminate the chain of causation for the losses. As the court put it, and this is at the joint appendix of 2280, I understand the law of this circuit to be that you can't take into account the effect of PCI's own fraud and false conduct. The court was relying heavily on a case that is actually a Third Circuit case, Jimenez, which is also factually distinct. Like some of the cases cited by the government's brief, this is a case of multiple causation, a case where there are a number of factors that result in the same loss. It is not a case of an independent intervening criminal act so that the loss is then cut off for the causation for this defendant, and that loss then becomes the result of a different offender's conduct, not concerted action, an independent event. And that's what happened here. The only case that's cited by the parties that presents that situation is the Hicks case out of the Ninth Circuit. In that case, the court said that when you have an independent intervening criminal conduct by a third party, not foreseeable, and not based on the criminal activity undertaken by the defendant, the losses resulting from that third party's criminal conduct are not losses that resulted from the defendant's conduct.
To accept that argument, do you have to believe that your client thought when he left it was going to be converted into a legitimate operation?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay, would you distinguish or explain that to me?
Absolutely. There's no change in this regard. When my client was operating A&O, they went out and they bought these bonds. It was part of the investment package. They spent millions of dollars buying these bonds. And what the bonds said is if the insured is still alive as of the bonding date, then the bonding company pay out the proceeds. And so the investment was designed that we were going to need enough money to pay premiums at most through that bond date. If the insured dies sooner, the insurance carrier will pay out the policy. If the insured is still alive on that date, the bonding company will pay out that policy. So we know the most amount of premiums that we're going to need in order to keep that policy alive that gets paid out. That was true while my client was there. At the time he left, there were $67.6 million worth of policies that were prepaid through the bonding date.
So are you saying he was running a legitimate enterprise?
No, Your Honor.
Legitimate before? Until he left and then...
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that at all.
All right, so he's running a fraudulent scheme.
Without question, Your Honor, the jury found that he lied in order to induce investors to make investments. Right. He also lied about how he was going to pay those premiums. But the fact of the matter is, he did pay the premiums. And the fact of the matter is, when he left, there were policies that had $67.6 million of premiums prepaid, meaning that if the bonding company performed as it had guaranteed that it was going to do, and there's no evidence in the record that my client had any reason to disbelieve that the loss is overstated by $67.6 million.
Are you saying that even though he was lying and setting up this fraudulent scheme, he thought it would work and everybody would get paid and everybody would make money as promised?
Well, Judge Traxler, that's true, but that would go to intended loss. What we're talking about here is actual loss, and we're talking about...
But I'm wondering what he thought was going to be different after he left.
Your Honor, it doesn't matter what he thought about after he left.
Well,
after
it
he left,
whether or not it's foreseeable or not.
Not for this point, Your Honor. After he left, regardless of how the new owners operated the business, there's nothing the new owners could have done to screw this up. Regardless of what the new owners did, they had life insurance policies for which no additional premiums were due that were worth $67 million. If PCI had performed, there would have been $67 million that would have come back in to be able to repay investments, regardless of what the new owners did. And the only reason that did not happen is because PCI was a fraud that took those premiums and never had any intention of performing. And in fact, the United States Attorney's Office has prosecuted PCI for that fraud and has not alleged that there was any concerted activity or those were co-conspirators. That was an independent fraud. That fraud caused that loss.
So there's no honor among thieves or between thieves. And so your argument, I guess, is that if thief number one is unlucky enough to be dealing with thief number two, then thief number one is not charged with foreseeing that just like he constructs a pretty elaborate, sophisticated fraud scheme, that he's not also going to be a victim and magnify the loss to everybody. Well, I mean, that's essentially your argument.
Essentially, 2 points, Your Honor. One, it's not a matter of foreseeability. The district court did not find that Mr. Allmendinger could have foreseen PCI's fraud. That was not a factual finding. There was no evidence to which to make that factual finding. Rather, what he found is, I can't consider thief number two's conduct. Essentially, you assumed the risk.
But didn't they lie to PCI to get the bonds?
No, not these bonds, Your Honor.
The whole thing was a lie. How could they have gotten the bonds without lying as to the basis for seeking the bonds?
No, they didn't lie about the basis for seeking bonds. Let me clarify.
Okay.
I think what you're talking about is there were a half a dozen bonds that were policies that were so-called wet policies or LRP supported policies. That represented 1% of the policies. The other 99% of the or 1% of the contracts. The other 99% of the contracts were not wet policies. They were uncontested policies. They were policies that PCI was obligated to pay. If I have a portfolio, Your Honor, that has 99% grade A stocks
now
in it,
you're
and 1%,
you're talking to me about degree, matters of degree.
No,
not matters of kind.
No, I'm talking about two entirely different investments. One, investments that are good, legitimate, worth money, worth $67 million if PCI pays, and then a handful of investments that are conceitedly worthless. I'm not putting any value on that 1%. I'm not saying there should be any reduction of loss whatsoever for that 1%. What I'm saying, for the 99%, my client caused investors to invest. He is convicted of fraud. He is going to get a substantial penalty for that. The question is, how much should the enhancement be for loss that he caused? And he did not cause the loss that PCI caused. He couldn't have foreseen it. He didn't foresee it. There's no factual finding that he foresaw it. And the court believed erroneously that legally it was not entitled to consider the fact that that was loss resulting from an independent actor. And in fact, the exact converse is true. He was required to consider the fact that that was loss resulting from an independent actor. It is not loss resulting from the defendant. Had PCI performed as they were obligated to do, without anybody paying any additional premiums, no matter how unscrupulous the new owners were, Judge Traxler, there would have been $67 million, if not another dime of premiums had been paid. Now, the fact of the matter is, Mr. Allmendinger, during his tenure, did pay premiums. He paid $10.8 million worth of premiums during his tenure, and he left $3 million with A&O when he left that he believed was going to be used to pay premiums. Had those monies been used to pay premiums and had PCI performed, the investors would have been made whole. That does not mean there was not a fraud, but it means that there was no loss from that fraud that resulted from my client's conduct. But at a bare minimum, the trial court overstates by $67 million the amount of the loss. If I might move on to a couple of other issues briefly, the unwarranted sentencing disparity, 3553A6. This is a procedural error. The court sets forth its reasons for the sentence it is pronouncing at JA 2414 to 2420. The court notes that there are some of the enhancements under the guidelines overlap. He notes the fact that Mr. Allmendinger did pay premiums and did buy these bonds. And he talks about the need for specific and general deterrence. In fact, almost the entire discussion relates to the need for specific and general deterrence. A6 does not make a distinction between the need for no unwarranted disparity between defendants in the case and outside of the case, but the fact is that the trial court did not articulate a reason for either. He did not explain why he thought it was appropriate that Mr. Allmendinger receive a sentence 4.5 times that of a similarly situated co-defendant, nor did he address the extensive argument by counsel, both in the sentencing memorandum and at the sentencing hearing, about other defendants in other cases. His reasoning simply is not set forth in the record. Under Carter, it's not for this court to simply assume why he did what he did. On the constructive amendment issue, again, very briefly, in Miller, the court said that normally a narrowing is not considered a constructive amendment. It did not set forth a bright line rule. It says that normally it won't be. It says generally it won't be. It repeatedly indicates that there may be some situations where it is. And I would submit if there is ever a situation where it is, it is in this case where there was an actual amendment changing about a third of the indictment, changing the time frames, changing the co-conspirators, changing the number of investors, changing the amount of the fraud, not just deleting extraneous information, but actually changing it. And in those circumstances, we do have a constructive amendment. And then finally, on the departure issue, I started by talking about the calculation of the actual loss under the guidelines, which undoubtedly the court had to calculate, regardless of what it did on variances. It had to calculate that and had to calculate that correctly. The court believed it had no discretion to consider the over-seriousness, whether the loss overstated the seriousness of the offense under the guidelines, and it then in some way, in part, took account for that in the variance. That was a legal error to believe that he didn't have any discretion to consider it under the guidelines, so it's not simply a matter of he exercised his discretion to use a variance instead. It's that he believed that he lacked discretion, and that warrants reversal, and it makes a real difference. When he was talking about doing it under the guidelines, he was talking about being at a level 39, a range of 262 to 327, he ends up, even after the variance, at a sentence of 540 months, more than 9.5 years greater than the high end of the range that he thought the guidelines would take care of if he thought he had the discretion to do it under the guidelines. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal unless the court has additional questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dry.
Hard to look cool when that happens. May it please the court, the United States respectfully asks this court to affirm the jury's verdict in the district court sentence in this case. Turning to the loss amount figure that defense counsel raised, as an initial matter, the court found it rejected the Hicks analysis and went with the majority opinion that intervening acts of third parties does not result in a reduction in the loss amount. This is supported by this court's holding in Mallory, it's supported by Jimenez, and it makes sense. Basically, what happened in this case is the district court said, look, you engaged in a scheme that had lies throughout. You lied about everything about the company, and you lied about how you were going to prepay premiums and safeguard investor funds. If you take a look at what caused losses in this case, it was because the policies lapsed. PCI was not required to pay on policies that had lapsed. The defense attorney's own expert testified at sentencing that at the time Allmendinger left, the amount of money present was not sufficient to keep all of the policies in force. And then it was a back and forth about, well, how much could have been in force if they used 3% of the premiums like they had done for the previous 7 months? Would that have been able to keep them in force? And ultimately, the district court made the factual finding that no, when you execute a scheme like this, there is no honor among thieves. You cannot get a free pass because you bonded the policies, but the policies were going to lapse, PCI wasn't going to have to pay, and you even executed a fraud against PCI itself with the LRP, fake life expectancies, and the wet policies. The defendant says that the district court said that it could not consider the PCI fraud in determining the amount of losses. The court did consider it in the variance, but just found when you execute a scheme like this, you cannot basically go to the casino and bet the investor money and take all of the upside and none of the downside risk, which is exactly what this court held in Mallory you should not be allowed to do. Mr. Pollack keeps, throughout his brief and in the argument, he said the investors would have been made whole. No, they would not. They would not be made whole. At the time Allmendinger left, he knew that some of the policies were going to lapse. He left $2.9 million, tried to wash his hands and run away so that he would not be on the hook for the inevitable investor losses.
Well, how much would be required to be left as retained capital in that company to pay them all off?
Your Honor, to pay the principal back plus the expected return? Are we talking the premiums?
Premiums.
The evidence in the record said that the $2.9 million was less than half of that would have been required to keep all the policies in force. And what's interesting in this case is the court knew that it could depart, and it kept asking Mr. Pollack, what is the method of departure I would use? What is the methodology? And Mr. Pollack admitted, look, Your Honor, it's hard to come up with a way that for a mathematical precision that we could figure out what amount of loss should be attributed to the defendant for the departure basis. But now he comes before this court and says that somehow the district court made a mistake by not doing what Mr. Pollack admitted couldn't be done. Mr. Pollack says that there was nothing new that the owners of this company could do to interfere with the investments. But when Mr. Allmendinger left, the factual findings of the district court made clear that the district court said that Mr. Allmendinger, it was reasonably foreseeable to him that this scheme would continue in the exact same manner it did, which the district court's findings were that they used the investor money as their personal piggy bank. It's reasonable when Mr. Allmendinger leaves and he knows his co-conspirator, Wahab, is going to continue, that, hey, they're using money as it comes in, they're buying Lamborghinis with it, they're doing all this thefts of investor funds. It's reasonable to think that that $2.9 million might not make it there to make the investor whole. And Mr. Allmendinger didn't care. When he sold his company, what due diligence did he do? He didn't even know who he sold the company to. He asked no questions. He didn't try and safeguard the funds and put it in escrow so that that money could be used in premium for premium payments. He didn't care one iota about the investors. Now, Mr. Pollack argues that there was an unwarranted sentencing disparity and that the district court failed to make a particularized assessment, and cites this court's holding in Carter. Carter is readily distinguishable. In Carter, the district court made a two-sentence sentencing finding and made basically just listed the factor, the 3553A6 or A factors, and made no particularized findings about that defendant. In this case, out of a 300-page sentencing transcript, this is a very lengthy sentencing that went from 9 in the morning to 7 o'clock at night, the district court made particularized findings that lasted 7 pages just about this defendant. It found that that Mr. Allmendinger lacked any acceptance of responsibility. It noted his attempts to extricate himself from the scheme to avoid the regulatory pressure and what would happen after the scheme fell apart. It noted his efforts to hide money, spending it lavishly, all the while he knows he's going to be indicted. Think about the position the sentencing court judge is in. He's got a defendant that has a restraining order against him, and what does he do? He goes and continues to spend the investor funds lavishly, setting up a scheme to flee, actually trying to make it so. And then when he is unsuccessful, he says, well, you know, I'm similarly situated to Mr. Oncall. No. Mr. Oncall pled guilty, and Mr. Allmendinger did not. Mr. Pollack makes a big deal about this being a trial penalty. This is not a trial penalty, that Mr. Allmendinger was penalized for going to trial. That's not what happened in this case. Mr. Oncall pled guilty agreed to plead guilty about 7 months prior to indictment. The government, exercising its prosecutorial discretion, gave him a plea agreement that included 2 371 counts. The statutory maximum sentence available in this case for Mr. Oncall was 10 years. That was all that was available. And Judge Payne gave him every day of that 10 years. It isn't that Mr. Allmendinger's sentence was too long. It was that Mr. On-Call was given the benefit of cooperating with the government. He testified at 3 trials. He cooperated proactively. And quite frankly, the government needed his cooperation during the investigation to bring this case to light. And the Supreme Court has explicitly held that the exercise of prosecutorial discretion does not implicate unwarranted sentencing disparities. And in fact, this court's holding in Perez-Pena, it said that comparing a defendant who assists the government with one that doesn't is like comparing apples to oranges, and that Congress could not have intended that disparities resulting from the exercise of prosecutorial discretion could be determined to be unwarranted. Mr. Pollack argues that there was a constructive amendment in this case, and he cites the Miller Court, the Miller Supreme Court opinion. Your Honor, the indictment, the redacted indictment in this case, was merely narrowed. It was narrowed in scope of participants, in duration, in overt acts, but it was never expanded. It had the same purpose. It had the same misrepresentations that were told to investors about A&O, A&O's use of investor funds, and prepayment of premiums in the escrow account. There was absolutely nothing that was necessary to the charges that was redacted from the indictment. And in fact, Mr. Pollack himself in the motion to strike argued that before the severance, that all of the allegations post August 31st of 2007 should be redacted. But now he comes before the court and says, no, those were necessary allegations. If you read his motion to strike in note 6, he says, no, actually they're not necessary, and this court could strike them without resubmission of the grand jury. In his reply brief, he argues, well, it's different. A constructive amendment is different. This is a literal change in the indictment which would require a representment to the grand jury. But his motion to strike, he actually suggests that the court literally change the ending date of the conspiracy to August of 2007. Now he comes before this court and says, no, if you change that, then that would require presentment to the grand jury.
But you can't take advantage of invited error, can you?
Your Honor, structural. The government completely agrees, and we're not arguing that it's invited error, but we are arguing that it's somewhat disingenuous to say that, yes, those factual allegations were necessary to the indictment, and then come before the appellate court and say, no, really, the district court, after saying to the district court, no, they're really not. It's not invited error. It's not a legal conclusion, Your Honor. But in this case, when you have a redacted indictment that basically is the same charges as to Mr. Allmendinger, the same allegations as to Mr. Allmendinger that were contained in the original indictment, how could an impermissible amendment occur? The sole reason that the evidence at trial and the redacted indictment appeared the way they did was because the trial was severed. The allegations as to Mr. On-Call basically ended in August of 2007. After the severance, the government did what it is allowed to do under this court's holding in Wilson and says, we're going to limit our evidence to the time frame of the conspiracy in which Mr. Allmendinger was an active participant. There's nothing impermissible about that. And every argument about a literal change in the redacted indictment, what was changed was the ending date of the conspiracy. What was changed was the number of investors and the amount of investor funds that were taken in until August of 2007. None of those are elements of the offense. And for an impermissible amendment to occur, it has to affect an element of the offense. And nowhere in Mr. Pollack's pleadings can he point to any of this as an element of the offense. Mr. Pollack argues that the district court erred because it thought it did not have the discretion to depart. The district court recognized that it had the discretion to depart. If you look at the record, what was occurring at that point was we had the argument about whether the loss amounts overstated it. We were going to 2B1.1, looking in the commentary and note, note 19. And Mr. Pollack was arguing in the alternative, Your Honor, if you don't think that this is that the loss amount should be reduced, then Jimenez says you can consider that for a departure basis. But what he's really saying is, Your Honor, if you don't think we should follow Hicks and you're following Jimenez, then go ahead and use as a departure basis the fact that this was an unforeseeable intervening event. And what the district court found was, well, actually, Jimenez, to apply that basis, Jimenez says it's a downward departure basis when it's unforeseeable. I found it was foreseeable. I found that when you operate a business like this, then, you know, it's foreseeable that the investors would lose their money. So the district court understood it had the ability or the legal ability to depart. It just shows that the facts weren't warranted in this case. And that's a factual finding. It wasn't a misinterpretation of the case law in this case. Your Honor, these are tough cases to try. They're tough cases to sentence. There's a lot of moving parts. But at the end of the day, what happened in this case was the defendant was tried on the exact same charges that he was indicted on. The district court, in a sentencing proceeding spanning 300 pages of the transcript, made factual findings about loss amounts. Admittedly, there are a lot of moving pieces if you want to get into the minutiae, but the district court made factual findings that, no, the way the defendant operated this scheme, he's on the hook for the investor losses. You can't lie to investors, retirees, actively soliciting retirement funds, and say, look, I promise there's no risk that the policies are going to lapse because I'm going to prepay the premiums. Don't pay the prepay the premiums, and then argue, well, it really wasn't foreseeable that the policies would lapse. And the defendant's sentence is both procedurally and substantively reasonable. When you look at a 45-year sentence for a white-collar defendant, at first blush, you're like, wow, that's a long sentence. There's no denying that. But when you look at the path of destruction, if you look at the sentencing transcripts and you read the victim testimony and the path of destruction that this type of crime wreaks on 845 victims, many of who lost their life savings, then you understand that the sentence was proportionate to the crime in this case. If the court doesn't have any additional questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dryant.
Your Honor.
Mr. Pollack.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Dry says that Mr. Allmendinger didn't care whether or not the investors got paid. The fact of the matter is, for 100% of these life insurance policies, 100% of them, he went out and he bought these PCI bonds that were supposed to guarantee that they would be paid. Guarantee that they would be paid on the bonding date as long as the premiums had been paid through the bonding date. For $67 million worth of policies, when he left, they had already been prepaid through the bonding date. Meaning, regardless of what the new owners of A&O did, the only thing that needed to happen for those $67 million to be paid and be available for investors was for PCI to do what was contractually obligated to do. And there is no finding that it was foreseeable to Mr. Allmendinger that they would not do it. Rather, the finding is, well, if you operate a shady business, you assume the risk and you're responsible for every consequence. It's an absolute liability assumption of risk type standard, but that's not the standard. The standard is a proximate cause standard, and an intervening criminal act cuts off that causation. Regardless of what he does with departures, regardless of what he does with variances, the first step is to calculate the actual loss. He's required to do that. Mallory does not say anything differently. What Mallory says is that foreseeability is part of that calculation. What Mallory says is foreseeability is not part of the second step, which is any offset. So here, if I wanted to argue to you, well, the bankruptcy court only recovered $8 million, they should have recovered $10 million, and it wasn't foreseeable that they would only have recovered $8 million. Mallory says, no, I don't get to argue that. But we're not there. We're not in the second step. We're in the first step. What was the actual loss that resulted from Allmendinger? What resulted from Allmendinger was a scenario where he lied to investors, he took in money, but he also bought bonds that would guarantee that those bonds would be paid if the premiums were paid through the bonding date, and they were for $67 million. He also left $2.9 million in the bank when he sold the business. Now, Mr. Dry says, well, that wasn't enough. That would only, you needed twice that much to keep 100% of the policies alive through the bonding date. That's true. But what Mr. Dry doesn't tell you is they didn't need 100% of the policies to be alive through the bonding date. They had far more policies than they had investment dollars. When Mr. Allmendinger left, they had taken in $80 million worth of investments. They had policies that were worth $138 million. They didn't need all of those policies to pay out. For loss purposes, you're only talking about return of principal. They needed $80 million for the amount of the loss to be zero under the guidelines. They had $67 million that were prepaid, and the undisputed testimony is that if that $2.9 was used for premiums, forget the wet policies, forget the LRP policies, if that $2.9 had been used to keep alive the 99% of the policies that were valuable policies, it would have kept alive enough that there would have been $111 million available to repay investors at a time that he only had $80 million worth of investors. Had PCI performed.
What did your client do to ensure even that his post-involvement that would happen, other than just selling it and walking away?
Well, what he did is he prepaid, he had policies that had prepaid premiums of $67 million.
That's what he was running it. I'm talking about.
No, but that's already done. So that's going to last after he's gone. So the bonding date is after he's gone, but the premium's already paid. So the new owners don't have to pay a dime of premiums.
Well, don't you think it's
when we get to the bonding date, PCI has to pay $67 million, period. No new premiums have to be paid. Your question is, what did he do to ensure that they'd have more than $67 million to get up beyond the 80? And the answer to that, Your Honor, is he left $2.9 million in the bank. And the judge says, well, it's foreseeable that the new owners would run the business exactly the way the old owners did. That's correct. When Mr. Allmendinger was running the business, they were lying to the investors to get them to invest, but the fact is they were paying the premiums. And he had every reason to believe that the new business would pay the premiums as they came due. They weren't prepaying 100% as they promised that they would. And you see that because he had $80 million worth of investors, but he only had $67 million worth of prepaid premiums. So that's a fraud. But they were paying the premiums as they came due. No premiums were in arrears. No policies had lapsed. In fact, no policy lapsed for a year and a half after he left. When he was there during his tenure, the record is undisputed, the principals took out about 23% of the money to themselves and used the other monies to buy bonds, to buy premiums. After he left, the principals took out more than 50% of the money. They took out $12.5 million within months of when he sold the business, and they stopped paying premiums.
I think that's like Judge Davis said, that's degree and not difference in terms of kind, because they followed his pattern, stealing from the company.
And if that's true, if it was foreseeable for him that they would double the degree, and if one accepts that that's not a difference in kind, that means that you wouldn't have spent 100% of the 2.9 to pay premiums, and you can debate. We can debate, should $67 million have been available or $111 million if 100% or somewhere in between. What we can't debate is that 67 would have been available.
I think you'd have a pretty strong argument if the new owners had branched into, say, contract murders.
Your Honor, I would
agree with you that Mr. Allmendinger should not be charged with the loss resulting from that kind of expansion.
But what we need to distinguish between is the new owners and PCI, two totally different things.
I understand your argument.
And PCI, if they had performed, even if the new owners had branched into murders, and even if you said that was foreseeable to Allmendinger, had PCI performed, the investors still, at most, would have lost the difference between the 80 and the 67 offset by the bankruptcy. You're talking about a couple million dollars. You're not talking about the $95 million that the district court found. There's no scenario, regardless of what the new owners did, that there could have been a loss of that magnitude unless you had an intervening criminal act by PCI that nobody foresaw.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.